chapter at 5. Breaking news, 82 tower blocks have failed new safety tests in the wake of the Grenfell Tower fire. The government's just confirmed an independent review of building regulations and fire safety following the disaster. Meanwhile, the MP for Kensington says senior councillors and decision makers linked to the blaze refurbishment cannot stay in their roles. Claire Gregory reports.
Emma Dent Code was speaking after police said there are grounds for corporate manslaughter charges. Elizabeth Campbell is leader of Kensington and Chelsea Council.
We'll do everything that we can as a council to help the police in their investigation.
Nabil Shouker lost relatives in the fire.
We're still very angry why it's taken this long.
Local Jackie Haynes welcomes the progress.
We need to make sure that nobody ever has to go through this.
Meanwhile, a man accused of lying about losing family members in the fire has pleaded not guilty to fraud. It's alleged Anne Nguyen did it to get hold of cash.
Japanese broadcaster NHK says North Korea has fired a missile which landed off the coast of Japan. The Pentagon's confirmed it's detected a launch. The Irish Prime Minister says Ireland is opposed to an economic border with Northern Ireland and will not help the UK design one. The barrier between the two countries is a key issue as Britain negotiates its divorce from the European Union. The former PM, Tony Blair, previously argued Brexit would result in a hard border. His ex-chief of staff, Jonathan Powell, says it's heading that way.
There have been platitudes ever since of people saying, no, they won't, we're going to find a way around a hard border. And it's becoming increasingly clear they haven't got a way around a hard border. The only way around it would be for the United Kingdom as a whole to remain in the single market and in the customs union.
A gang who stole more than £400,000 worth of designer goods from John Terry's mansion have been jailed for nearly 28 years. Four men targeted the former England captain's home in Surrey in February.
BCFM 93.2 plays more Bristol music than any other station.
Love Bristol.
Love
BCFM 93.2.
A Bristol kind of love.
It's Friday, it's 5 o'clock. Welcome to BCFM's politics show. I'm Tony Gosling, helping me review this week's news. It's a Labour Party councillor for Eastern Ruth Pickersgill and leader of the Lib Dem group, Noel councillor Gary Hopkins. After the 6 o'clock news, in Hebrew it's called the Tish B'Av. That's Israel's annual national mourning this weekend for the second destruction of the Jerusalem Temple around 43 AD. That's an anniversary from long ago when the Romans invaded Britain about that time. Originally, it was built by Solomon around 975 BC, the temple, and spending the last two-thirds of its history as a ruin, a flat piece of stone now. But the Zionists are back in charge in occupied Jerusalem. They intend to rebuild what they see as their temple, and why not? Only one problem. The third most holy site in Islam, the Al-Aqsa Mosque, is in the way. It may have to be demolished to make way for the temple some Jews want to see rebuilt. Because the Zionist Third Temple Institute conduct a ceremony every year to lay the first bricks of the new Jewish temple and by implication to begin the process to demolish the Al-Aqsa Mosque. The end of July is always tension runs high around the city. So we hear from some experts on the conflict tonight, from E. Michael Jones, who's written a book, The Jewish Revolutionary Spirit, and from Israeli-born jazz musician, author of the book on Jewish identity politics, The Wandering Who, Gilad Atzmon. And we ask tonight, what's the root of what's both a secular and a religious conflict? And can the international community be alerted to the dangers before more Zionists and Arabs die, sucking the rest of the world possibly into a wider war? I'll be joined by former UN Yemen worker Dr. Judith Brown to look at the wider Middle East conflicts, and also to retired Anglican vicar and author on Christian Zionism, Stephen Sizer. That's in the second hour after six. On to our news review in a minute, but first, Bristol's two-weekend weather forecast from theweatheroutlook.com. Tonight, lows of 14 Celsius, plenty of showers. This weekend, highs of 18 Celsius, some sunshine, lots of showers during the weekend. Next week, highs of 21. plenty of sunny spells, but also plenty of showers. I don't like that phrase, plenty of showers. I think that's too many showers, probably. And next weekend, 5th and 6th of August, mainly sunny spells, less showers. Next weekend, anyway. That was Bristol's two-weekend weather forecast from theweatheroutlook.com. So helping us review this week's news, Labour Party councillor for Easton, Ruth Pickersgill. Hi, Ruth. Welcome to The Politics Show.
Hello.
Can you tell us a bit about, because you became a councillor for the first time last year, what got you into politics and why the Labour Party?
Well, the Labour Party is the easy thing to answer because I've always been in the Labour Party from student days, really, and there would be no other party that I would ever get involved with.
Why is that? Why not?
I mean, I was inspired by going to a meeting with Tony Benn, actually, back in the day. I was actively involved in CND and was one of those people who were embracing the base and getting involved in Greenham and various other things. And I went along to a rally that Tony Benn was speaking at. And it was one of those days when he was waxing lyrical and talking about world politics and British politics and a whole heap of other things. And I remember coming out and thinking, my goodness, for the first time, the world makes sense. And it was really kind of his vision and his personality and everything that attracted me into the Labour Party. And I've never left it.
Is it really that bad that other politics and the media, the mainstream press, really don't seem to really make sense? Things don't add up in the bigger, wider world?
I'm somebody who likes to have a framework to work within, and my framework has always been one of socialism and pacifism and social justice, and my entire career has been around working around equality issues, particularly in education. And for me, that I need to make sense of things in some way or other to be able to operate. So, yeah.
Well, a lot of those equalities are being addressed, have been addressed, but one hasn't, and that is the wealth divide, isn't it? It seems to be getting worse and worse all the time, the rich getting richer and the poor getting poorer. So do you sometimes feel a bit dispirited getting involved in equalities when there's that divide opening up?
I do feel dispirited most of the time at the moment, actually, to be honest. I think that issue is an enormous issue, and one of the things that I was so proud about becoming a Labour councillor was our commitment to trying to do something about inequality in terms of poverty and trying to tackle poverty and try to tackle marginalisation. And really, a lot of our discussions this year have been how to actually address the gaps in the city. You know, just down the road here in Lawrence Hill, we've got areas that are one of the, you know, in the 10% most deprived in the country. So that's completely unacceptable. And at the same time, other parts of this area are getting richer and, you know, and people have got much longer life expectancy and things. So those are absolutely crucial. But I don't think we've solved the other equality issues either. And they're all mixed up together. So on the whole, it is women who are also economically deprived, disabled people 13 times more likely to live in poverty than other groups. So I don't think we've solved the other equality issues. And I think this government has been going backwards significantly on other equality issues. So it's not a case that we've kind of sorted some and we've got to move on to new ones. We've just got to carry on banging on with every single bit of injustice that's being foisted on us at the moment, really.
Well, one of the things that I found so horrendous, and we had people who were being sacked at the time a few years ago here under the coalition government, was when Remploy was closed down. It was Bristol had its own Remploy depot where a lot of disabled people various sorts could get employment. In fact, it was, I think it was set up by Winston Churchill after World War II, and yet the Tory coalition government closed that down. I mean, it's just almost the most horrendous thing. If someone has particularly built up friendship networks, are able to go to work every day with a little bit of help from central government, and yet they're saying, well, actually, if you can't compete with the fit and able, then you're just not worth a job. Mm-hmm. And that's, in fact, what's happened to many disabled people now. They've been told, right, well, you're just going to have to get into a rat race with fit and able people.
Well, I think being older, one thing you've got is a long perspective. And I can remember the time when I worked for Avon in the 1980s, and we had some really positive schemes then to support disabled people into employment that carried on with some sort of level of support. So people were working in mainstream settings, but they had a support worker or they had additional time for things, or there were subsidies for their employment. So there were a lot of really, really good schemes that particularly helped people with learning difficulties into work. And actually Avon and then Bristol for some time kind of supported a lot of them. But over the years, with austerity, more and more and more of that support has been cut. And access to work, for example, is criminal, the fact that access to work should be a right to disabled people. You should have a right to get your needs met so that you can do a job. And that's being gradually whittled away. So all the things that enabled disabled people to be out there and earning a living and, you know, being included have, in my view, got considerably worse over the last 10 to 15 years.
It must be peculiar coming in as a councillor at this time, because you're in a situation where the mayor is just having to implement cuts after cuts. I think it's 30 million a year at the moment. And so although it's not what you want to be doing, I mean, is there actually anything you can do as a councillor to slow that process down?
I mean, obviously, it's down to the government, and we can do things. I mean, there's lots of discussion at the moment about lobbying Parliament and what we can do there. Obviously, we work really hard to get a different election result. You know, we need to make that change nationally. But locally, what we can do is try and involve people in making decisions about how we do use the money we have got. And, you know, I don't like the cuts. I don't think any of us like the cuts. And no, it isn't a good time to become a councillor. It's an absolutely awful time to become a councillor. But all I can do is work alongside the people in my ward who are being affected by them, and to do everything I can to try and get a better outcome for them.
I mean, is there anything you can point to that you say, at least, you know, I've been able to do something for one of the people in my ward to help?
I think most days there is a piece of casework where I think I've been able to do something. I've maybe helped somebody get rehoused. I've maybe got the rubbish moved from outside somebody's house. I've do quite a lot of work because my background's in education. I've supported quite a few families in terms of education concerns that they've brought to me. So on an individual basis, that's probably the most rewarding part of the job. You can get things done, and sometimes a prompt from a counsellor actually does make a bit of a difference. But the big issues we can't solve, because the officers are working as hard as they possibly can without enough resources. And, you know, I can't suddenly create housing in Easton, and I've got people right, left and centre having to move out of the ward or being evicted because they can't pay the rents anymore. And that's completely frustrating. And I might be able to help one individual person find a new home or get out of temporary accommodation, which, you know, I have done on a few occasions. But, you know, that isn't solving the problem. And when we've got, you know, new housing being built without affordable housing in it, it's really not an easy situation to be working as a part of.
So Marvin leading a lobby to Westminster, will that make any difference? Because I can imagine the Conservatives saying, well, so what? We're just going to carry on with what we're going to do beforehand.
I think there's a whole...
For another 5 years?
I think it has to be in a context. I think having a leader of the city who's willing to work with other parties to talk to the government, to reason with the government. I mean, Marvin and Claire Hiscott went to see Nick Gibbs to talk about schools funding. I think establishing those relationships, having those conversations, means that you get taken more seriously when you do something like lobby. So lobbying on its own isn't going to change things, but there's an awful lot of other work going on with the other core cities and with other world leaders, actually, with mayors around the world, to try and address some of the key economic things and austerity and things like that.
Maybe so. That's where it all happens, at this big mayor's jamboree. I think there's quite a lot of mayors. Anyway, Gary Hopkins is with us too. He's the Lib Dem leader. Gary, you've been doing some lobbying around the pool, haven't you, down in Knowle?
Well, local councillors can make a difference. And actually, getting the administration together with the operators in a more constructive way actually meant that, no, we're not paying, the council isn't paying out more money. It isn't just a matter of money. It was a matter of attitude and doing the job right. And just a few months ago, you know, one of our vital local bus services was being taken away because of indolence, basically, from the administration, and First Bus acting in a normal, arrogant manner. And we managed to get it replaced, and we provided a bus service that wouldn't have been there if local councillors hadn't fought hard. Yes, there's all the individual things that you do as a councillor, but sometimes it's those things for the community, fighting for your local parks and that sort of thing. That's the first job of a councillor.
What about the pool?
Well, I mean, basically, some years ago, There was a revamp of the pools across the city, and some were closing, and we opened a number. We opened the one in Hengrove at the time, as involved that with that.
This is when the Lib Dems were in charge?
That's correct, yes. We opened the new one at Hengrove. There was the new one at Bishop's, up from Bishopston. And actually, we opened quite a number of libraries as well, which at the moment are massively under threat. But some of the old libraries, like some of the old pools, like Bristol North Bass and Speedwell Pool, were just not savable. One or two that we managed to invest money in. And, you know, we came to a position with the Jubilee Pool back in 2011, where actually the contract, the PFI, had been signed on Hengrove, which actually gave the operator of that the right to object to Jubilee Pool staying open. And the only way that we could get it to stay open was investing in a new gym and having the same operator run Hengrove Pool and Jubilee Pool. And actually, you know, the operators did a good job, and it works. The two of them address different markets, and it works very well indeed. But this time, you know, earlier this year, it was cabinet decision, close Jubilee Pool. I'm afraid, sorry, but that was the wrong decision.
So have you managed to turn it round or what?
Yes. The community was annoyed. But actually they had some hope because they knew that we'd saved it 5 years ago by that investment. We got 6,000 signatures together on a petition, which is quite a feat for a comparatively small area. And we made the case. And we spoke to the operators, and they said, well, there's that much local demand, and you're going to give us a hand with the marketing, which we said we would do, then that gives them confidence to carry on. And they said, we'll work for no subsidy, and that's what they've agreed to do.
Well, it's amazing, really, isn't it? And it does make you wonder, Ruth, doesn't it, what's going on with the administration when councillors like you or Gary have got to get involved in order to actually keep things running, even if it's just a little bit of arm twisting and saying, please keep this open, because otherwise we're going to make your life hell.
Well, there's been all sorts of discussions about this pool, and I really commend the amount of public involvement, and we've had loads of statements, loads of discussions, petitions in council. But the issue was the subsidy, and there's a lot of contention about whether the proposal actually was to close the pool or whether the proposal was to stop the subsidy, and they're actually very different things. And you know, we've saved a pool, but we've saved a pool that wasn't necessarily a pool that was going to be closed. So I think, you know, I think the technicalities of it aren't really the thing we need to talk about today. We need to find creative ways as communities to keep a lot of these facilities going. So, you know, everybody talks about cuts all the time, but actually what we really need in a lot of these situations is creativity. And like Gary says, we do need to be talking with the community about new ways to run things and trying to be a bit more entrepreneurial in the way we operate.
Really. But isn't Marvin under quite a lot of pressure just to close things down and sell them off?
Well, there is pressure, obviously, and there are easy things. Well, it's not easy to close anything or cut anything, but sometimes those options long term are not the best options. So actually, what the consultation that's going on at the moment, is not saying let's close everything. What it's saying is if people can cut up with creative ideas to make things work, then that's what we need to look at. And people are. I mean, I know in lots of areas where there's threats to a library or there's threats to a school crossing or there's threats to a public toilet, people are already coming up with ideas about, actually, we could do it differently, we could work it differently. I mean, other cities have sort of relocated children's centres into libraries. I know they've tried to look at that in one of the wards near here. And, you know, we just need to be thinking differently. I think, you know, the idea that it's cut or not cut isn't where we're at the moment. It's actually about being creative and trying to do the best in a very, very difficult situation.
I'm afraid the consultation on the library exposes all of that. Basically, there are different ways, there are different models. Senior civil servants came down to Bristol not that long ago and explained some of the different models for keeping library services open. those have been completely put to one side, and the choices on libraries that have been put to the population are, we're going to close 11, it's just which 11 we're going to close. And it said, we're not going to use volunteers. Now, that's not an open consultation. It says, which disaster are we going to head for? And there are models and ways of actually keeping our library service functioning. I wouldn't choose to have to rely on volunteers. I think we should keep the staff. But the decision has been made in terms of how much money that the administration wants to save on that, and they are under pressure. But I can tell you that large amounts of money are wasted. The reason I brought in the tablet here is because looking at the number of redundancies, voluntary redundancies, which cost an absolute fortune, which affect the budget, in fact, because the largest part of our spending is staff. Back in 14-15, nearly 800 people were made redundant by voluntary or compulsory redundancy. And so the workforce was slashed at huge cost. The next year, which was just before the mayor was up for re-election, the number of redundancies was practically zero. We were actually increasing the number of staff the next year. Now, that costs an absolute fortune, and I'm afraid it's not an efficient way to run an organisation. To actually get rid of huge numbers of staff at large cost and then think what you're going to do is not the right way. I understand now, by the way, that the announced 1,000 redundancies are found not to be necessary. And I'm sure that's the right decision. But that was the reaction. Oh, God, we've got this huge overhang from the previous administration. We're going to have to make a huge number of redundancies. That's not the right way forward. And the figures also show, going back before the first mayor, that we were actually reducing the workforce and saving money because we were under pressure, but without huge number of redundancies, by proper management of the workforce and looking through department by department and doing the job properly.
I think that's happening as well, and I think all of us would recognise it's much better to have voluntary redundancies than to have compulsory redundancies, and that was what the process was. But I think the issue at the moment isn't that. The issue is we need the right people in the council with the right entrepreneurial skills and the right flair and creativity to try and reconfigure the way we work. So I totally agree we should be going through and reviewing each area and looking at getting the right people, because what worries me is some of the people who are leaving. It's not the fact that we've got a programme of voluntary redundancies. It's actually about who chooses them, because who chooses to go? Because what we can't afford to do is lose the really good expertise and get left with people who don't have the skills that we need. So we've got to be very sharp on that and on actually making sure we keep the right people with the right expertise and don't lose organisational knowledge.
And that's why large voluntary redundancy schemes are a disaster, because what actually happens is the people who leave are those who say, thank you very much, I'll have those £10,000 or whatever it is, and I've got another job to go to because I'm very employable.
Well, maybe
and we lose a lot of our best staff.
Maybe one of the people who left was whoever it was in charge of looking after vulnerable children, because there's a horrendous story this week in the Bristol Post. The council gives over £270,000 of free money back to the government after failing to spend it on vulnerable children. The government grant was supposed to be spent on supporting school children in care, but the city council didn't realise they had it, so they had to send. This is about £250,000, Ruth. It's not a very good way to spend money, by not knowing you've got it, then having to give it back.
My understanding of the situation, and I'm actually a governor on the Hope School, which is the virtual school for children in care, and my understanding is this was to do with the way that the government changed the regulations around the spending of the money, and it's quite complicated because there's pupil premium money that goes to schools to support these children, so it's not a question of the local authority just has it. The local authority gives it to schools, but we're very rigorous about how we give it to schools. And in the past, we've been able to carry it forward, and there's a delay period between where the schools actually give us the information to show they're using it properly, so they're not just spending it on anything, that they're spending it on the right children at the right time. So there's obviously a delay. And this year, we weren't able to carry it forward. We had to give it back, is my understanding.
Isn't it better to be a bit less rigorous and actually have the money and distribute it rather than say, oh, well, I'm sorry, but we just haven't filled out all the right paperwork. You're not going to get anything.
Well, clearly it is, but this was brought to our attention quite late on in the day. So I think what we need to be clear about is that we've actually got a really, really good system for working with children in care in our schools, and they're very well supported. And we know absolutely that their outcomes are monitored closely, and that, you know, people are looking at what's happening to them, that the money's actually getting spent on them. We're not squandering it on other people. But no, this isn't something we're pleased about.
I chatted to Ruth briefly on the phone about this. Ruth Pickersgill, who's, I think, no, sorry, no, Ros, well, that's you, isn't it, Ruth?
It's me.
It's Ros Clark, who's, I think, chairing audit about this. And she said, actually, it looks like the next audit committee, they're going to come up with another big figure of another load of money, which they're going to have to send back to central government. Just sounds to me like maybe the wrong people are taking early redundancy.
It's not the fault of the governors of the virtual school. It's the fault of the finance officers within the city council, who were too busy looking at, you know, rules and regulations and tying things down, rather than paying attention to what they needed to pay their attention to. And I do happen to know, because a number of finance officers on their way out have spoken to me, it's not a happy ship in there, and things are not in great shape. Morale is not good, and I'm afraid they should have informed the governors of the change in the government regulations, so the money
was
not
sent
back. So
was morale good under George Ferguson, when he was using creative accounting, juggling the figures?
With some people it was, but there was a lot of unhappiness in a lot of departments.
I can't imagine morale is particularly good in any public service, public sector agency at the moment, really, because we've, you know, everybody has been putting up with these cuts for years and years and years, and it takes quite a long time to turn things around. And, you know, we've had a year trying to turn around morale, but it takes a long time. And people are working so hard. They're working so hard for so little reward. The rules change every 5 minutes. They get new bits of legislation they have to implement with no extra money. And, you know, I am really quite defensive of a lot of the officers in the council who are doing the job to the best of their ability.
Do you ever feel like an official receiver closing something down? Because, I mean, that's effectively what it looks like, isn't it? By 2022 or something, it's going to be an end to central government money coming to Bristol.
Well, it certainly is. It's getting worse and worse, but we've got to fight to try and make it different. I mean, we don't know when we're going to get the next general election, and I know that's not, you know, it's not the only answer, but it's the best answer we've got.
I'm afraid that's no answer at all. I mean, you know, a magic money tree does not actually exist. There's a lot of the promises made in the election campaign already been, said, oh no, that's an aspiration, it's not a promise. And basically, at the end of the day, that where we part company from the Labour Party is that we wish to give people the opportunity to help themselves, but we also recognise the need to balance the books. And you can't in the long term keep on spending money that you don't actually have, because somebody's got to pay it back.
And I think that's what Marvin has been actually very good at, is trying to get a grip on balancing the books.
Yeah, he's coming for quite a lot of criticism
for doing that.
Let's bring old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers in. Martin, what do you make of all this?
Well, I'm sick of hearing about magic money trees. Tell that to Arlene Foster in Northern Ireland, where they're not having to make cuts for political reasons.
Absolutely shocking.
Yeah, well, I mean, that's the reality. And, of course, the other thing is that what's happened, we've had three, you know, don't forget the coalition government said it was going to reduce the deficit to zero in one term of Parliament. They couldn't do that because they lost the country's AAA credit rating. People have forgotten all about that. We used to have a AAA credit rating, and then George Osborne lost it. And he lost it because he tried to cut too far too fast. Now, in other words, what's beginning to happen now, we're getting back to a more realistic understanding of how the real economy really works. There is no magic money tree. You can't run deficits forever. But on the other hand, you need to run a deficit when the economy is going down the drain, which is exactly what the first coalition government didn't do and lost the AAA credit rating. Then they started to press the accelerator, and of course, therefore, the economy didn't collapse. Don't forget, after Brexit, there was a massive surge of quantitative easing, which kept the housing prices up, and therefore, the effect of Brexit is only now feeding in to the figures. So I think what's happened is people have wised up to the idea that there's no money. There's plenty of money. It's all in the Cayman Islands. And don't forget, in the 1950s, the top rate of tax in Britain, when we were fighting the Korean War, we may soon be fighting another one, was 95% in Britain and in the US. That's when capitalism properly worked. When the wealthy were taxed, the money was spent on other stuff, and capitalism ran along fine. What we've got is the more we get an unequal society, the less efficient capitalism becomes. And what people have rumbled this now, I don't think anybody can get elected in this country by promising just to cut things. It's no good.
But Martin, the game's over. I mean, we know there's quite a lot of money up at the Promenade at Merchant Venturers Hall. I mean, they've been going since the mid-1500s, accumulating wealth. No one knows how much money they've got. It's all their accounts are covered by immunity, crown immunity, because it's a royal charter, and they don't have to file accounts at Companies House. And probably most of their money is over in Switzerland. So even if there is an increase in the level of tax, you're not going to get your hands on their money, are you?
Well, I mean, that you're coming back to the micro level of what's going on in Bristol. But the fact is, once you've used quantitative easing, we've had 8 years of quantitative easing now, the allocation of resources that happens after that is no longer a market allocation of resources. Quantitative easing basically pushes up asset values for the asset-owning classes. About one-third of the population owns significant assets. Their assets have been protected by quantitative easing, but that's not a market decision, and it's not because they built a better widget or are more entrepreneurial, as you were saying earlier, Ruth. Can I just pick up on that? One of the problems with this language of entrepreneurialism is that we're giving too much away. The government should do what it's supposed to do, as it always used to do before 1979, and we're of a similar age. We remember when it used to be run properly. Yeah. And of course, we've had years and years and years of silly policies like privatising railways, etc., privatising utilities, deregulating financial markets, etc. And of course, if you take a long perspective, we're now going to have a big pendulum swing the other way. And I think even Gary will be on that pendulum.
Well, one of the consequences of all this is actually quite a nasty rise in crime. We actually last week we were talking about the rise in problems in our prisons. That is to say, drugs, etc., in prisons, violent crime going on in prisons, turning our prisons into universities of crime, in fact, with nowhere near enough prison officers there. But one of the other aspects to all of this is a big increase in knife crime that was noticed last week in London. And so we're going to hear now, there is no parliament sitting at the moment, but one of the clips I didn't use from last week was a worrying one about knife crime. And this is with Sarah Jones, after a question of the Prime Minister Theresa May last Wednesday at Prime Minister questions.
Sarah Jones.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. Does the Prime Minister agree that the huge increase in knife crime has tragic consequences for families in constituencies like mine? What will the Prime Minister do to work with me and other MPs across this House to find solutions to this blight on young lives, including looking again at the budget for policing?
Yeah. Well, can I also welcome the Honourable Lady to the House, to her place in the House. Her presence here, of course, has enabled me to have a very good Chief of Staff appointed into my office in number 10. But she raises this issue. The issue of knife crime. She's raised a very serious issue of knife crime. The government has been taking a tougher stance on knife crime. We do think this is an issue. We've done this in a whole variety of ways, so that now if you carry a knife in public, you are much more likely to go to prison. But we do recognise there's more to do in this area. That's why yesterday my right honourable friend, the Home Secretary, did announce plans to consult on new offences to toughen up knife crime laws, including restricting the online sale of knives. We've done some of that already. We think that it's more for us to do, and banning possession of dangerous or offensive weapons on private property. So the Honourable Lady has raised an issue that I think is important. The Government has been addressing this. We recognise we need to do more, and that's what my right honourable friend, the Home Secretary, is doing.
Well, nobody wants to see increases in knife crime, but I think this is one of those things that it's very, very difficult to find easy solutions. You've got a lot of people who are alienated from society, very young teenagers, for example, the culture in which they're growing up is one in which they feel they have to carry a knife to defend themselves. That's often the case. And, of course, we're nothing like the United States of America, where we wouldn't be talking about knives, we'd be talking about submachine guns.
Well, one of the things she's talking about there, that is Sarah Jones, is the reduction in policing, and a massive reduction.
Well, yeah.
It's shameful. The Tories were claiming for a short while that, oh, well, yes, we're cutting down the number of police, but the crime is going down, but it takes two or three years for it to feed through the system. And the biggest problem, actually, because it isn't just knife crime, it isn't just violent crime, it's all crime is now starting to move up. And the reason for it is, firstly, the basic services of local community policing. Because if small crimes happen and there's no consequence, then they'd move on to larger and bigger crimes. And I'm afraid some communities are being left completely unsupported.
Well, I can remember last year there was a lot of arrests around drug dealing. The only problem being that it was often mostly the homeless and very poor drug dealers, which puts one load into jail. But it leaves lots of unemployed people to fill their place, and it just seems to sort of, actually, it's almost a way of recruiting a whole new generation of young people into crime. Anyway, Ruth, what were you going to say? And I would just agree with Gary as well, that it's a right across the board increase in crime last week.
Yeah, I mean, I was going to agree with Gary that it is about the community policing, and in an area like Eastern, it's absolutely crucial that we have more PCSOs working on the ground, because they know the community. I mean, I hadn't really been involved in this area until I became a councillor. But I've worked for a long time with disengaged young people. But what I've been really impressed with is the amount of support that the PCSOs are able to give the community, and how they do actually know what's going on. They're very aware of what's going on. They're trying to find resolutions to things that aren't necessarily just punitive, but they haven't got enough people doing it. I mean, at night down Stapleton Road, when there are issues, people are supposed to report 101, but there aren't enough PCSOs or any other police to come out and actually deal with anything other than real emergencies. So low-level things that could easily be sorted out if they had more people on the beat and more resources actually end up escalating. And I can see it every day, really. And they're doing all they can. They're working really hard, but they just don't have the people to do the
work.
Sorry.
The PCSOs were a very, very good invention. A previous Labour government brought these in. Unfortunately, before they were brought in, they cut the amount of money that was going to be allocated to them. And I actually was the person who did the deal with Avon and Somerset Police, that the council was paying money to Avon and Somerset so that we got more PCSOs on the street in Bristol. And that had an enormous effect on community safety. Unfortunately, the previous mayor just did not understand the issue at all, and the numbers were allowed to slip below a critical number. So basically, communities just slipped out of feeling supported, and the PCSO has been able to do their job. And I'm afraid George just did not understand crime or community safety.
Have you noticed any different sort of style of being a mayor from Marvin to George? I mean, because it's really up to the personality of the individual to how much they keep decisions and power to themselves, and how much they share it a bit amongst the city councillors.
Well, I think the system itself is a very dangerous one. However they behave afterwards, if you put all the power in one person's hands rather than effectively all councillors having a say, then it will lead to bad decisions. Different styles, but bad decisions. And I've seen bad decisions from both mayors.
What about you, Ruth? Do you think, because we've got a system, haven't we? Not talking about Marvin's personality. What do you think of the system?
I mean, I wasn't somebody who was in favour of the mayoral system in the first place. But we have a system, and I think what's different now is an attempt to have a city office that pulls in all sorts of other partners. So a recognition that, you know, it isn't a one-man show. It is about all of the parts of the city working together to make the city better. And actually, I've noticed, having observed lots of meetings in the past and now looking at the chamber from the inside, that there is a very different and much less adversarial way of operating. And I think there have been quite a lot of examples this year of really good cross-party working on a number of issues that have actually made a difference. So I'm you know, I do feel it is different. I think the style is different. And I think the substance is different as well.
Just to clarify, with that clip we just heard from Prime Minister's question, Sarah Jones was asking Prime Minister Theresa May about knife crime. But Theresa May said something about, thank you very much for, it almost seemed like winning, beating the Tories in the general election, because she is a new MP who removed the former housing minister, Gavin Barwell, in her constituency. And the what wasn't mentioned, though, was all the controversy around this, which is related to the Grenfell Tower fire, where Gavin Barwell, when he was housing minister, sat on this fire safety report over tower blocks. And we're hearing today that there are 60 tower blocks around the country that desperately need, that have failed, basically, the fire review. And yet most of the people living at those tower blocks still haven't been told, Gary.
Yes. I mean, firstly, can we give a bit of reassurance to people in Bristol? Because for quite a number of years, the issues with tower blocks and the cladding and the safety measures has been taken very seriously by a series of administrations. And I think generally a very good job has actually been done. And it's interesting that Mr. Barwell, having lost his seat, has now become a close advisor to Theresa May. Really quite unfortunate under the circumstances.
Yeah, he's apparently just barged his way past reporters, ignoring all their questions, and he hasn't made any comment whatsoever about this report he suppressed, Ruth.
I think this tragic incident has just shown all sorts of things about our society and the way it's been operating that really, you know, have come to the fore about, and it's about poverty. It's what you were saying right back at the beginning of the show, about how in one small ward you've got the extremes of wealth and poverty, and decisions have been made that would not have been made in a posh housing estate. You know, people have not taken the care and attention that they should have done for the people that most need it.
But what's really concerning about this is this guy, Gavin Barwell, he's the one who's suppressed this report, which may have saved the lives of people in Grenfell Tower, and yet he's now Chief of Staff at Number 10.
Well, I'm hoping the inquiry will look at all of those areas, and that will come out.
Well, the locals don't like it, because even though there's some talk today about, and yesterday about, corporate manslaughter charges, it means that there'll be a fine for Kensington and Chelsea Council, and nobody's going to be personally held responsible. I think, you know, the locals are fuming.
Yeah, they are, and quite rightly. I mean, who wouldn't be in that sort of situation?
Yes, I mean, it's hardly going to hit Kensington and Chelsea. They've got the largest reserves proportionally of any local authority in Europe. So basically, the fine's not going to hurt them all that badly, is it? But I think also it's been very dangerous, some of the language that we've actually had from Labour politicians trying to take political advantage of this. They're not all like that, let's be clear. But I'm afraid John McDonnell talking about murder, when, yes, I'm sure lots of bad decisions have been made by lots of people, but we don't know.
Well, what about deliberate bad decisions? Because these residents back in November last year, they said, look, only a fire is going to make anyone pay attention, and a loss of many lives is going to be the only thing that makes anyone pay attention to our plight here.
I think murder is completely the wrong word to use. I'm sure bad decisions have been made by people in central government, possibly in local government. Possibly there's been some poor behaviour by contractors. I don't know, and we need to see the details of that. But to be throwing around a word like murder when we haven't actually got to the bottom of what really caused the problem is very, very concerning.
Martin, what do you make of these calls by the police saying that they are going to be corporate manslaughter charges, I think?
Well, I think McDonald was probably copying Engels' term social murder. But, I mean, in any case, people gone about political correctness. I'm afraid people are going to have to get used to language being used like this, and if they don't like it, well, that's just too bad. The fact of the matter is that they shouldn't have put that cladding up. It was totally inappropriate. And Fielding Mellon?
Rock Fielding Mellon, yes.
Yes, well, I mean, but what he did was because he wanted to get his kids into a private preparatory school, he gave the school a rent agreement which would let them off 300 grand, and his kid got the place in the school. That money would easily have paid paid for proper cladding on the housing. But of course, there's no reason to put cladding.
Actually, Martin, he got a pat on the back, didn't he, for saving costs on this refurbishment?
Oh, yes, that's right. But also, the cladding was only put up on the building to try and make the place look nicer. It didn't actually do anything for the building. And I think this has already been established before we've had an inquiry. And of course, what the locals are saying is, to hell with inquiries, why aren't the police carrying out a police investigation of this? Not just an inquiry to find out who might be, you know, made to take the scapegoated, but, you know, that there is clearly, basically, been fingers in the till and all the rest of it. And it's, you know, I just think this is got, what happened with that fire at the end of the general election campaign is it really brought home why people getting the short end of the stick in this society are getting fed up with the whole thing that's been going on for years and years and years.
Okay, well, talking about the other end of the spectrum, Jacob Rees-Mogg, local MP to Bristol, just a few miles away in near Bath and Somerset. He's now second favourite to replace Theresa May as the next Tory leader. The Tory backbencher appears to be emerging as a threat to David Davis, who's widely thought to be the front runner. Well, I mean, I don't know about widely thought, but what do you make of Jacob Rees-Mogg taking over the country, Gary?
Well, you just couldn't make it up, could you? I mean, it just goes from one farce to another. I mean, Theresa May was promoted to leader on a record of abject failure in everything she's actually done. And I've yet to see anything that Jacob Rees-Mogg has actually achieved. Apart from providing some amusement on a couple of panel shows with people laughing at him rather than with him.
Okay, he's an old Etonian, Ruth. Do you think he'll make a good Prime Minister?
I think he'd make an absolutely appalling Prime Minister. But the worrying thing at the moment is that there does seem to be an issue about personalities. And, I mean, if what we thought was a reasonably sensible country can elect Donald Trump, then I worry what this country would be capable of. I hope we wouldn't do anything ridiculous, but I mean, people's track record needs to be looked at, and I think we look far too much at personalities. And the thing at the moment is everybody doesn't want anyone who looks establishment or, you know, in any way.
Or sounds establishment. Like Jacob Rees-Mogg.
Well, it was an interesting discussion last night and the night before on Newsnight about elitists and who's elitist in the White House and who's not elitist. And, I mean, it's interesting that we've kind of lost those discussions here at the moment, and the fact that, you know, we have been run by private school, you know, Etonians for so long, and somehow now he's seen as quite an attractive figure by people. It defies all logic to me, really.
He's very, very pro Brexit. I think he's absolutely clear that it's going to be a hard Brexit. We're going to sever almost all ties, maybe even fill in the Channel Tunnel.
Well, I mean, it's the biggest political and financial threat we've actually got. And I don't think I've ever agreed with Tony Blair on anything previously. But when he said, you know, we get the left, we get the right hook from the Tory party with Brexit, followed by a left hook from Corbyn if he takes over government, country's finished.
Ruth, what do you make of the implications of Brexit? We've been also having some mixed messages this week. First of all, I think it was Tuesday, they were saying, oh, it's going to be definitely no free movement after Brexit. And now they're saying, well, it looks like there may be a few years of free movement still.
Well, I mean, it's all over the place at the moment, isn't it? And somebody, one of the ministers this week, was saying, well, there will be free movement, but we probably won't call it free movement, and it'll be for a transition time, so it'll be a different thing, but it will look a bit like free movement now. I mean, we're at that point where absolutely nobody knows what anybody is doing, and it's really hard for those of us in Bristol who fought to remain and still passionately believe that would have been the right decision. And we've got nothing to work with from this government. Nobody's saying anything sensible at all.
Well, at last I can see on this story, let's see if we can get up to date on what the Conservative government are saying on this. Whether it will be the same in a few hours' time, it's anyone's guess. But anyway, the Chancellor, Philip Hammond, said the EU nationals will be free to work in the UK for years after Brexit, says Chancellor Philip Hammond. That's just a few hours ago. He's revealed most of the Cabinet agree there needs to be a lengthy transitional arrangement after Brexit, Martin.
Yeah, well, I mean, I was a Remain voter as well. I was somewhat dismayed by Jeremy Corbyn suggesting that we're leaving the single market. I thought we hadn't agreed that yet. We may or may not leave the single market.
Is it a market in people or goods?
Well, it's a market in both.
Or everything.
Yes, that's the whole point about a single market.
Isn't there something a bit perverse about treating people as goods?
Well, in the economics, I'm afraid people are treated as economic producers and consumers. That's the basis of economics, I'm afraid. And that includes whether they are allowed to work in countries and move across borders and so on. I think what I want to see is a sensible discussion about the way forward here. I'm willing to accept that there's a mandate, if you want to call it that, for Brexit, even though, of course, if it was a trade union election, it wouldn't be regarded as a sufficient mandate for a strike. And it's certainly, for example, in the 79, when the Scots voted on having devolution, they won 50% plus one, but they didn't get 55%, so they had to wait another 10 years for another go.
But can you see why people are fed up with this attitude? Well, if you vote one way, even if it's a small majority, you have another vote, and you keep having another vote until you vote the way that Brussels want. This is what happened with the Lisbon Treaty, for example.
Well, what happens with referendums is people change their minds. They want to have another vote if they've changed their minds. And what's happened now is, but Remainers have accepted that there's going to be a Brexit, because otherwise we'll have to have a massive row about having another referendum. All right, well, we'll drop that. So what we want now is probably the least worst option, which is everybody to be practical about what the options are. And of course, there's nothing in the referendum that suggests that we can't stay in the single market. It wasn't a referendum on the single market. It was a referendum on leaving the EU. The obvious model is Norway, which is outside the EU, and they've tried several times to pass referendums to get them into the EU. They don't want to join the EU, but they've got everything apart from the EU. Being a member, of course, they have to pay into the EU budget. They don't get anything out. They can't control the regulations, but they can say they're free.
Okay,
so we could be the same.
Just a day ago, the headlines in the BBC on this were that EU UK freedom of movement will end in March 2019. So it seems like there's been a big change around with Philip Hammond today. Maybe it's because the Prime Minister's on her walking holiday in Switzerland.
No, I mean you've basically got Hammond trying to.
Nobody's in charge.
Well, he's actually trying to speak reality to the headbangers that are surrounding him, and really he's got an almost impossible job. He might be boring, but he is trying to keep some reality within the cabinet. But I mean, you've got the Tory party led by a woman who wanted to remain, dealing with a lot of lunatics on her back benches, and you've got the Labour Party, where you've got quite sensible MPs who want to remain, led by somebody who's determined to get out.
Well, I'm glad we've got some sensible MPs. I think that I'm glad that's been acknowledged. Yes,
we've
got some really.
McDonnell and Corbyn, I think.
And when Jacob Rees-Mogg takes over, it's going to be all hell will break loose.
Well. But I think some of the things that we've been really clear about are about the contribution that overseas workers make to our economy. I mean, Bristol NHS, Bristol Health, our health and social care in particular in Bristol will fall to pieces if we don't have workers from overseas.
Yeah, we are going to have them, and they can stay. I mean, that's been made pretty clear, hasn't it?
Well, but the longer-term arrangements are not clear at all, and people have started talking about the agricultural policy, the impact that on our farmers that it's going to have and everything else. And these things should have been talked about before. What's so frustrating is that the discussions were not had before the referendum. And I know we can't go back
to introduce another aspect to the whole Brexit thing, which I was meant to bring in last week when we had a former Royal Navy officer who's standing for UKIP, that's Ben Walker, on. But I just think it shows how distant some of the stuff in Brussels is. And this is the former Green MEP from Ireland, that's Patricia McKenna, talking about how much the actual arms industry controls policy over in Brussels.
Where did this European Defence Agency come from? When I was in the European Parliament in the early 90s, I discovered that the European arms industries were lobbying the European Commission because they were bemoaning the fact that since the end of the Cold War, there was a massive slump in arms sales. Terrible thing that people aren't buying enough weapons anymore to go out and kill people with. So what they did was they lobbied the European Commission to set up an agency that would represent their interests and that they would be on. That agency was set up, it was originally called the European Armaments Agency. But at the Thessalonica Summit in 2000, it was agreed to establish, they changed the name, a European Defence Agency. The European Defence Agency. Where did it come from? It came from the lobbying by the arms industries to get this set up. And why I'm saying that is very important. It's like putting the fox in with the chickens to try and control. The European Defence Agency is not going to turn around and say to member states, oh, we think you should demilitarise a little bit. We think you should cut back on arms spendings. Why would they? For God's sake, their livelihood depends on it. The arms industries depend on member states spending more on military capabilities. So there are two very important things here. One is in relation to the key role that the arms industry has in EU policy making on armament spending. And the second thing is, there is a commitment to a common defence. It's there in the treaties, and Britain has no opt-out. Now, I just want to go on as well to talk about foreign policy itself. And we have been presented with this. The European Union is a wonderful peace project. If it wasn't for the European Union, we wouldn't have peace in Europe. We wouldn't have peace in other parts of the world. Europe has been very instrumental in promoting peace in all these different countries. It's the new modern type of colonisation by the European Union to exploit the resources of the developing countries. In relation to Sri Lanka, where the Scandinavian countries were negotiating with Sri Lanka in relation to trying to come to a peace deal. And the European Union stuck its oar in there and prevented that from actually happening. And the Norwegians were left on their own because the European Union calls the shots and decides what's going to happen. And even if it's in the interest of peace. And in fact, what the European Union did was actually completely counterproductive and encouraged and facilitated violence as opposed to helping to prevent it.
Now that's Patricia McKenna. I don't think she'd be allowed to stand as an MEP for the Greens at the moment because they're pro-EU, but she was in the 1990s. What do you make of this whole issue of sovereignty? Because what she's talking about there is one of the worrying things about Brussels, isn't it, that Gary, that you've got quite a lot of corporate lobbying going on at a central level and not a lot of democracy.
There's an awful lot of lobbying goes on at Westminster, at Brussels, anywhere there's any spending, or Bristol City Council even, you know, although we've got less money, there's a huge amount of lobbying goes on there. And bluntly, yes, Martin's right that the Norway model would be much better than what this government and the Labour Party are heading towards, but bluntly, you know, why go for second best? We need, when people actually realise what the true cost is, it's not a rerun of a previous referendum. It's saying to people, do you want this or not?
Ruth, there is a potential problem here, isn't there, that British people really wouldn't get much of a say in foreign policy, and it's even more worrying if the arms industry are very powerful through the European Defence Agency in actually helping set that foreign policy.
Well, I mean, it's shocking what we've just heard, but as Gary says, I don't think it would be any different if Britain had total sovereignty. The arms trade are powerful. They have huge lobby over our parliament. So I can't see that actually it's going to be any different. And you can be within something and reform it more effectively from inside than outside sometimes. So I don't really understand that, you know, that's a reason to get rid of, you know, our involvement in Europe at all. And I do believe that it has been a force for good in terms of peace in Europe. I do think that's been positive.
Okay, time for the Murdoch News at 6 now. Thanks to our guests, Labour Party Councillor for Eastern Ruth Piggersgill, leader of the Lib Dem group, Noel, Councillor Gary Hopkins. After the news, we go to Jerusalem.
On your mobile, BCFM is an award-winning community radio station for Bristol, bringing you national news on the hour, live from the Sky News Centre.